Welcome to the audio format of POS 214 Politics in Africa 2. This audio format is brought to by schooldrillers.com. In this audio, we would discuss the topic in Lecture 3 of your POS 214 course material. Let's get started. Lecture 3, Topic, Approaches to the Study of Post-Independence African Politics. At the end of this lecture, you should be able to take note of the following area for examination. 1. Explain the meaning of paradigm. 2. Discuss the major paradigms to the study of post-independence African politics, and 3. Discuss the paradigms that is most adequate or scientific and comprehensive to interpret Africa's neocolonial and dependent status. Introduction. This lecture takes a look at the various approaches that can be used and have, in fact, been used to study post-independence African politics. In other words, we are going to discuss those frameworks which can be used to interpret and explain political phenomena on the African continent. Such approaches or frameworks make political data meaningful. They also permit us, by using certain theoretical constructs, to understand the observable political patterns and behaviors on the continent. Such approaches are collectively called paradigms. What is paradigms? Perhaps the most authoritative and most famous definition of paradigms is supplied by Thomas Kuhn in this book The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Chicago, 1962. According to him, paradigms are universally recognized scientific achievements that for a time provide model problems and solutions to a community of practitioners. This means that certain paradigms or frameworks are dominant at some time, but may not be preponderant at some other time. Other competing paradigms take their place as long as the users of those paradigms see them as the most suitable and appropriate to study salient and critical political phenomena. As Chalmers Johnson has summarized, paradigms define what scientific facts are and structure the work of normal science for a particular discipline at a particular time. Different paradigms or approaches. To analyze any given socio-political system on the continent, we can make use of the following. 1. Neoliberal paradigms of political analysis. 2. The neo-Marxist and the political economy approach. 3. The authentic African approach. Let's explain this one after the other. 1. Neoliberal paradigm. Several analytic frameworks can be subsumed under this paradigm. We shall treat only some of them here. 1. Perhaps the oldest of these frameworks is the institutional approach. In fact, for a long time, political scientists were using this approach in their researches and publications. This approach underlines the primacy or importance of political institutions like the parliament, executive, judiciary, presidential or cabinet systems of government, etc., in understanding the political process in Africa. It would appear today that this approach is not very useful. What Africanists, that is, those scholars who study Africa, do is to lay emphasis more on the political leadership than non-political institutions. This approach is particularly fashionable for one-party states and the militarist states, and as you know, most African states fall into either of these two categories. As we shall see later, the political leadership approach postulates the personalization and personification of power and authority by the leader. Given the mysticism and aura with which political leadership is tinged and surrounded, the state, if not also the society, may be regarded as political leadership written large. In short, you can study politics via Mr. President or Mr. Prime Minister or Mr. Head of State, as the case may be. 2. We also have, within the neoliberal paradigm, the Parsonian requisites approach. Talcott Parsons, a notable sociological theorist of value systems, has developed what we know as LIGO and Agile models. These models deal with pattern maintenance, integrative function, goal attainment and adaptive function of structures, norms and behavior, SNB, of a given society or the political society. To Parsons, once individuals imbibe societal values properly, they easily show commitments to pursue and support certain directions or types of action for the collectivity as a system. Of course, the emphasis of this approach is the maintenance of the equilibrium of the political society and the wider society. Perturbations in the system are quickly or frontally attacked by the state's arsenal of violence, force and coercion. Any criticism is perceived as subversive and against national security, while the critics are dubbed radicals, extremists, spoilers of social relations, etc. Again, while the inheritance elite has interests in maintaining a homeostasis, equilibrium, or rather the status quo as carried over from the colonial era, the non-inheritance elite who constitutes the majority wants an end to a socio-economic formation that perpetuates internal misery and external dependence and underdevelopment. 3. Capability and goal analysis. Given the high degree of Africa's dependency and underdevelopment, this approach is equally apt in apprehending and comprehending post-independence African politics. The capability analytic framework has as its focus the various elements that add up to give capacity or ability to perform or not to perform to a political system. Such elements include extractive, processual, productive and regulative capacities. A political system can therefore be studied on the basis of the foregoing. Goal analysis, on the other hand, goes beyond capability analytic framework. It concerns itself with means-ends relations. The issue is the extent to which the state or political system can use its capability to achieve its goal. What the goals or objectives of the state are fixed by the political leadership. However, it is difficult to differentiate between declared goals and achieved or realized goals. To what extent, for instance, has the DFRI, Directorate for Food, Roads and Rural Infrastructure, in Nigeria achieved its declared goals? This approach is also interested in the gap between self-perception and self-reality. Writing on this approach, Charles W. Anderson et al., in their book Issues of Political Development, assert that this approach helps us to unravel that many political systems that claims to be socialist, as a point of fact, devote a smaller proportion of their national budgets to welfare schemes and control a smaller percentage of the system's modes of production than many political systems which deny their socialist orientation. Number 2, the neo-Marxist and the political economy approach. This approach explains the structural nature of imperialism and Africa's neo-colonial political, economic, social and cultural order. Indeed, to understand African politics, it would appear necessary to understand the relationship between African states and Euro-American capitalist countries. The Marxist political economy approach is therefore indispensable, since it locates politics in its proper historical environment, namely, the structure and character of the colonial and neo-colonial economy and its alignment with international capitalism. I suggest that to understand this paradigm better, you should go over your post 213 lecture notes again. Now, this paradigm shows that because of what Johan Galtung calls structural imperialism, Africa's inheritance elite is closer to international neocolonial capitalist countries, agencies and agents than their own countrymen. The approach also suggests that there is a symbiotic relationship between the foreign ruling class and its national, African counterpart. We can also call it an alliance. But this alliance is detrimental to the masses of this continent. The material condition of the masses is further worsened by the fact that this alliance is a stable one. According to S. Langdon and M. Godfrey, this is due to the fundamentally compatible interests of local and foreign capitals. It is this objective situation that leads some scholars to regard Africans' middle class as a mere intermediary, or a comprador, go-between or transmission belt, for private, essentially foreign, capital. Some scholars would even say that by this role, African leaders and African states lack autonomy of action. Emmanuel Wallerstein is an example of such scholars. Hear him. In peripheral areas of the world economy, the primary contradiction is not between two groups within a stable structure. The primary contradiction is between the interests organized and located in the core countries and their local allies on the one hand, the majority of the population on the other. But then, This view raises some important questions. Can't the ruling class in Africa be something other than mere transmission line between international capital and national, local population? Can't it contribute to transforming the nation in some ways? Is it, as it were, condemned to playing the devil's advocate, that is, working mainly in the interest of the ex-metropole? In short, it is wholly correct to say, like one scholar, Nicholas Wainson, that the ruling class of the post-colonial state is the metropolitan bourgeoisie, represented by its agents, the multinational corporations and international aid agencies. Certainly, it is an exaggeration to say that the economic dependence of African states on international capital determines and explains all activities in these countries. What then is the position that is closer to reality? It is provided by scholars who adopt an approach anchored on what the French scholar, Nikos Poulantzas, calls internal and external causation. Ironically, Swainson seems to subscribe to this approach. According to her, to adequately capture Africa's condition or post-independence predicament, we need to examine the internal dynamics of the states, social formations in conjunction with their location in the world capitalist system. Thus, though most African states have incorporated certain peculiar features of contemporary imperialism, the concrete political and economic forms prevalent in post-colonial African states are shaped and conditioned by factors internal to those societies. What this internal-external causation thesis boils down to is that, at some levels, particularly political, the indigenous bourgeoisie or the ruling class is able to use the state apparatus to inaugurate economic nationalism. Indigenization in Nigeria and Zaire in 1972 and 1973 respectively. This is generally done, even without much success, to support national capital against foreign competitors. However, as Marxist and neo-Marxist political economists have argued, any attempt by a national ruling class to internationalize its production capacities will involve extensive links with foreign capital. Number 3, the authentic African approach. Perhaps, the scholar who has done much to give coherence to this approach is the eminent Nigerian political scientist, the late Professor B.J. Dudley. According to him in his 1982 book Introduction to Nigerian Government and Politics, this approach consists of demonstration effect between values that are socially conditioned and political behavior. This approach seeks to decolonize the conceptual biases of the functionalists, the developmentalists, the modernizers and other scholars of the mainstream or traditional Western, American, social sciences. The principal contradiction between African politics is best studied via the contradiction between Africa's community or moral order and the inherited legal economic order. Now, the values of the first order are different from those of the second. The legal economic order represents, for Dudley, a matter of unequal and exploitative relationships. But this pattern is not compatible with the moral basis of the community. In fact, the moral order is a fountain of imperative injunctions for its members. Victims of the unjust and unequal economic order are expected to be catered for by those who have. The demands of the moral order are such that those who own or possess have to consider a lot of socio-cultural arenas. They have to cater not only for the members of their own nuclear family, but also for the extended family system. Often, in order to satisfy the numerous exigencies of the moral order, the civil servant tends to regard the public treasury as an extension of his private purse. In a sense, therefore, the moral order encourages corruption while the legal economic order frowns at it. We have come to the end of Lecture 3, Pose 214. You can visit www.schooldrillers.com for more lecture. Thank you.